Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, coming live to you today from Esther's Follies at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas.
I think the young people would say, you nailed the assignment. Is that what they say? TikTok is confusing.
Our guest today needs no introduction. And if he does to you, tune in another podcast. You're in the wrong place.
Sassy Leonard today.
Our guest today is the one, the only, Frank Oz.
We're going to have everybody follow you around tonight and do that. Just so whatever, if it's the bathroom, wherever you go, my friend.
It'd be great for my ego.
That's what I'm saying. Well, this is the thing. My dad and I get a bit annoyed by the overuse of certain words, like legend or awesome.
Icon.
Icon.
Iconic.
But the thing is, and it's weird because you're a person, but you are those things. And I started to say to you backstage, something that absolutely blows my mind is that now my daughter is obsessed with the Muppets and with Sesame Street, and she will murder for Elmo. And, you know, you were part of creating, and there's many other things, but you were part of creating something that is still beloved. And I also, the other day, watched with my husband Indian in the Cupboard, which I hadn't seen in a while, but I loved that movie and I loved that book, and my daughter watched it with us, and is probably why she keeps putting toys in a cupboard, which does make more sense now. But it still plays, and it's beautiful. And this is the thing, to do all of these and to still have them have the meaning that they do. You can't bottle it. You can't force it. The industry would love it if you could, but you can't, and you've cut one heck of a swath.
Well, you know, as far as the Muppets go and Sesame Street, you know, I'm here alone, but there are people, there are about 40 people who should be behind me, and one certainly in front of me, Jim Henson, and there's, you know, Davy Goals, and the people we lost, Richie Hunt, Jim, Jerry Nelson, you know, a lot of people. So I'm kind of the hitching post at the moment. It's not that I'm denigrating my contribution. I think I contributed, but there's a lot of people here who really made it happen. You can't do this alone. You need somebody to play with, you know?
Well, but that's, you have. I mean, that's, you have played in the most significant ways. Which is why what we want to do today is start at the beginning.
Okay.
Because we will talk about Muppet Guys Talking,
okay,
which is the last time we got to see you here.
Right.
It's a wonderful documentary. We'll go back to that. But we would love to start at the beginning. Where did you grow up, and how did film become your passion? Because it is something you are so passionate about.
Well, it's interesting. I grew into that passion, and I love directing. I was born in England. Just about a few months before D-Day. My parents were Flemish and Dutch. We were in England because my mother couldn't take being in the Blitz underground anymore. And so they were Holocaust survivors. And after the war, they moved back to Antwerp in Belgium. My mother was born in Brugge, which is a Flemish version of Bruges. My father was born in Amsterdam. After the war, my dad wanted to immigrate to the United States. It took him about 5 years to get a visa. He had to go to Montana first, because at that time, maybe now, One, an immigrant has to have somebody who will be responsible financially for the first 6 months of staying there.
Right.
And so my dad and my mom brought me and my brother, I was about five, my brother about seven, from Belgium to New York first, passed through Ellis Island, and my father put us on the train in Grand Central Station to go to Montana. That means me, my mother, and my brother. But he didn't have enough money for his own ticket, so he hitchhiked to Montana. And then we lived in Montana in kind of a garage shack for about 6 months. And then when he had the opportunity, he had two possible jobs, one in the East Coast and one in California. He wanted California, so he hitchhiked to Oakland. And then he got the job there and brought us in, and we lived in an attic. Typical immigrant story, and I'm very proud of my parents. And then he built himself up, and then they were puppeteers in Belgium before the war. And when they immigrated to the United States, when we did, they really didn't do puppetry anymore because my dad had to make a living. He had, at that time, my brother and I and my sister. So they were in puppets more socially, but not really doing shows. Mm-hmm. And then I'm getting there, don't worry.
It is all about you, my friend. And please.
We have time.
Okay, I'm getting there. Don't anybody walking out yet? No, okay.
If they are, we can't see, so it's fine.
So I was a kid who, I think I've mentioned this before, so if you've heard it before, but I had very little self-esteem, didn't think much of myself, and my parents, and had some puppets around. So I started puppetry, and I did puppet shows around the San Francisco Bay Area from like 13 years on to about 17. I get $25 a show. I'd go to churches and birthday parties and fairs and bazaars, and it was a great training ground for live audiences.
So these are like hand puppets?
No, these are marionettes.
Marionettes?
Yeah, these are string puppets.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and I made them and all that stuff. But it was as an adult looking back, it was a safe way for me to perform without fear of rejection, because they weren't rejecting me, they'd be rejecting that in front of me. Yeah. And that took a long time to realize that. And then I wanted to be a journalist, so when I was 18, Jim had seen me perform when I was 17. And then when I was 18, I just stopped puppets. I didn't want puppets. I just wanted to be a journalist. And then Jim remembered my my performance when I was 17, and he asked me to come to New York when I was 19 to try it for 6 months just and see what happens. And so I promised my mom and dad I'd continue my education, and I went to New York. And at that time, it was a one-flat walk-up with two rooms. That was the Muppets then. 1963, and I continued to CCNY, City College of New York, but only for a year because it was too exciting to be with Jim, and I learned everything there, and then that's it. and then, what happened to the film? I just feel like I'm boring the hell out of you guys.
No.
Okay.
Honest what to happened? God, it's fascinating.
Okay, what happened then was I became very good at something. Because of Jim's, was anybody here last night at all? Yes. Oh, geez, then I got to repeat the same damn thing. I'm sorry, guys.
Frank, they like you. Okay. It's okay.
I'm going to repeat that. So I came, but I wasn't a puppeteer at that point. I mean, I really didn't know how to do the Muppets. And my first job that Jim gave me was to fill a fire extinguisher across town. So I was a gopher in the beginning, and then it took me 4 years. I performed, manipulated, but I was too frightened for 4 years to do any voices whatsoever. And Jim was about to give up on me, but then he forced me to do it for an Al Hertz special, I remember. And then I became good at something that I actually quit before. And then I loved working with the guys, and Jim, it was like a Camelot. Everybody, there's no backstabbing, there's no politics. It's everybody with Jim working for the good of the project, because we cared about each other. It was a rare, rare time because of Jim. But I had some frustration underneath because I didn't want to be a puppeteer. And I wasn't, actually, because I have no interest in puppets now at all. I'm a Muppet performer. I was. So I only performed the Muppets, nothing else puppeteering-wise. But Jim wanted to direct. He was actually an experimental filmmaker before Sesame Street. And eventually, over years and years, he was doing some film work, and I learned with 16-millimeter Bolex, and I'd go shoot thousands of reels, and I'd cut 16 on, for those of you who have any memory whatsoever of film, I'd use hot splicer, and I'd use guillotine splicer, and I'd cut original negs, and so I learned then, and then I gave myself 10 years to learn how to be a director. I believe in learning the basics first. So after about 5 years, Jim then asked me to direct Dark Crystal with him, which is now probably a $150 million film. It's just crazy. And that's what began my road to directing. And I think the passion started after Muppets Take Manhattan, because after Dark Crystal, he asked me to direct Muppets Take Manhattan. And that was really me alone for the first time. And I did, I don't know about you guys, but when you do something for the first time, I know what I felt was, there's so much I don't know in 15 years coming to look back and say, why did I do that? But I didn't know enough to not do it. So, but after Muppets Take Manhattan, then David Geffen asked me to do Little Shop of Horrors.
I'm gonna stop you.
Then, back off.
So we're off, yeah. And that's
just back off, okay? No.
Take him down.
To finish it off. That's when the passion of the film started. Sorry.
No, don't be sorry for any of it. It's. How clear are your memories of the immigration process?
My memory is not much, except that I remember we came over on Holland America Line. It was supposed to be like a 5-day voyage. It turned out to be 19. There was a hurricane.
Ooh.
And I remember tables flying. That's what I remember.
An image you would remember.
Yeah.
Some people, it's a Statue of Liberty. You were like, dinner.
And I remember the huge high snow in Montana and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And did your parents speak English prior to coming here? Obviously, a lot of people, both in Amsterdam and throughout those kinds of places, did.
They spoke French. I spoke French and Flemish, and so did my brother, and they spoke French and Flemish. But once they came to the United States, they only wanted to speak English. Mm-hmm. And then when my brother and I went to school, you're like sponges. And so now I don't remember Flemish or French, yeah. Only English, you know. Mm-hmm.
It happens.
Quel dommage.
Quel dommage.
That's about all I speak in French. Yeah. The idea that you were too frightened to perform is fascinating, because a lot of performers have permanent stage fright. How did you overcome it?
You know, Leonard, it wasn't stage fright. It was me thinking I wasn't good enough. Mm. Which is different than stage fright. I didn't think I was good enough for voices. I had never done voices when I did a marionette workers for birthday parties. So I did, for the first 4 years, I manipulated the characters and Jim did the voices. And finally, you know, he forced me. But it was because I didn't think I was good enough.
Wow.
I would pay money to watch the two of you coming up with the voices. I would give anything.
You know, it's funny. It's the master class. You know the master class on. They called me and asked me, could I do a master class on voices? And I said, no. I don't do voices. Right. I don't. Mel Blanc does voices.
Yeah.
I do characters.
Yeah.
And so I said, no, I'm not going to do that. The reason I'm answering your question that way is we don't work on voices. We work on characters, and eventually the voice just appears.
Right.
But Miss Piggy. Like.
Yeah, that That, again, it's all from character work. I have a whole background on Piggy. I know why she does things. And if I didn't have that character behind me, couldn't do the voice.
That's right. You're playing a complete character.
Yeah. I mean, Yoda, I didn't have the voice for Yoda in the beginning, and it's character. That's what answers. And it comes without you knowing it.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. It's kind of like being in a trance in some way, you know.
I think, you know, when one... You know, the goal of any performance is not to do great performance, but do a transcendent performance.
Mm-hmm. Where the audience isn't thinking about
right.
the mechanics.
Right. And so when that starts happening, then the voice kind of comes.
Right. Yeah. And because you're not thinking about the mechanics either.
If you're thinking about things, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what did you say to me, Daddy, earlier? You said, how was he Fozzie and directing at the same time, you know, for some of those movies? So just thinking, that is its own...
Yeah, because I've always been fascinated by this. I mean, today there's video playback, and
yeah.
you guys weren't on the ground floor of that as the Muppets.
Yeah.
But Charlie Chaplin didn't have that. Buster Keaton didn't have that. Laurence Olivier didn't have that. Orson Welles didn't have that. And yet they directed themselves... and some great performances and some great films.
Yeah.
How'd they do that? And I still marvel at that today, even though they can watch the playback immediately and see.
Because it's the idea that you can turn off. As a director, you are aware of all things, and you have to be.
Yeah.
Pardon me. As an actor, the idea is that you're just thinking about this one.
Well, I marvel at Buster Keaton, people like that.
Yeah.
I've read a few books on Buster Keaton. It's extraordinary. That kind of thing I marvel at. Once you have a video system, playback, I don't marvel as much.
Yeah, yeah. But still, when you're going, when you directed the Muppets Take Manhattan.
Yes.
You were behind the camera.
Yes.
And having established, did you storyboard those films?
I don't storyboard everything. I storyboard those things which I can't communicate to the crew by words.
Okay. Everybody has to know what the goal is.
Well, for instance, if there's a gag, if there's a special effect, if there's a crane shot, stuff that, you know, if I do overs and things, no, I'm not going to storyboard that.
Right. So you have to plan it and then execute it. And you're thinking about all the hundreds of things that are going on. Is that the lighting right? Is the costumes right? Is my co-star hitting the line the way I hoped they would? And then you have to forget all that temporarily and become Fozzie Bear.
Yeah.
Or become Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
And then the minute you're done with the reading for that line in that scene, you have to take on all that other responsibility again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the first one who's done that. Jim did that all the time. Because mm-hmm. He, it's very rare for a... part of the reason it works so well is the generous human being and the brilliant human being Jim was. But another reason why it worked so well is because there's very rare, I'm not even sure if I know of anybody, heads of companies who are in the pit with you all the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Who are actually doing the dirty work with you all the time. And he did more than anybody else. And I think that really worked. And Jim was the one also. Jim would, do his own characters, and he'd watch other people, and he was amazing. So I learned from him.
When I first saw Ralph on the Jimmy Dean show,
yeah,
who was I watching doing what?
I was, did you ever hear Ralph the dog? All right.
We are your people, Frank, I promise.
Okay. Ralph was on a... I came in, actually, when I was 19, I came in part to work with Jim and the Jimmy Dean Show. And Jimmy Dean Show was like 3 years. It was a series, actually a country western show every week. Too uptown, but nevertheless, I worked the right hand, and Jim did the left hand and the head and the voice. So I was just, apprenticing, really, at that time,
mm-hmm.
And it was so popular, it was so nice, because it became so popular that I remember somebody told me that there's a whole French colony somewhere in San Francisco, people who every week wanted to see La Nuit des Chiens, which is the night of the dog.
Wow. That was my first exposure to the Muppets. I know that the early show in Sam and Friends and the commercials and all of that, but that's, I was like 12 or something, and that was my first exposure, and it just wowed me and made me an instant fan overnight. And but we're getting back to filmmaking. When you took the reins as director, did Jim say anything to you? Did he? Was there no need to say anything to you about what he expected from you?
No, Jim never talked about that. Never taught you anything. Mm-hmm. Jim never told you what to do ever. Mm-hmm. We were at, you know, when we were during Dark Crystal, we were very close at that time, but he was. He cared about the product, and he knew that there were some things he was not as strong at, and I was stronger, and he wanted that to help me within that, even though it's his film, not mine. Mm-hmm. I helped him make his film. But even during that time, we went through all the work for years, but he never once told me what to do. He would never once tell the Muppet performers what to do. He only led by example. Mm-hmm.
Because people who are talented like that don't need to tell you that they're talented like that. People who are brilliant like that don't need to tell you they're brilliant like
and
that.
And people who are generous and have a good soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell to jump to Muppet Guys Talking, as I say, which is a documentary. When my dad got to, I think it was 2017 that my dad interviewed you with that. It is one of the most beautiful and heartbreaking documentaries.
Oh, thank you.
Because all of you... it is quite literally the Muppet Guys Talking. It is what it is. And the way that you all talk about Jim, but also everyone who was there at the time, I cried. Mm. It's so beautiful and so sad at the same time. And you love this man so much and you miss him. I'm jealous. What year did you interview him? Do you remember this?
Oh, well...
I know it jumps, but what year? Do you remember?
Well, first time, 1970 or 71. What year did Sesame Street come on the air?
69.
Well, in 69 or 70, I wrote for the Directors Guild magazine, and Bob Thomas, who was editing it at the time, would throw me a bone anytime he had a New York-based story. I would be his freelancer on call. And I spent a day and a half watching you guys. I was there the day they first...
This is my favorite Leonard fun fact.
I was there to witness the first performance of Rubber Ducky.
With, so good, right?
In the green room with Joe Raposo, who wrote it. And and I was there to profile John Stone, the director of Sesame, the initial director of Sesame Street.
Yeah, he was the father of Sesame Street.
Yeah.
But then, when did you interview Jim? When was that big one?
Well, that was, I think, for the Dark Crystal.
Okay.
Yeah.
He interviewed him, and towards the end of the interview, someone came out to join him.
Jim had like a medical, like an old-fashioned
permit.
Doctor's.
Yeah, Jim. Permit. Jim was good with that. He was happy to do that. You know, I'm not.
Yeah. I just, the idea that my dad was sitting on a stage with Jim Henson and Kermit, the jealousy is intense.
Well, also, Jim is always an introvert, so Kermit really helped in that situation, too.
Now, what was it like going on to something like Little Shop of Horrors? Which, again, in terms of the things that you've worked on and how they have stayed, you have an eye, and... I don't know what it is, it's the gift that you have, but Little Shop, please God, nobody else make it. Please, please nobody do a remake. Please just don't. Just leave it. It's perfect the way it is. Please don't do a remake. It's perfect. It's still perfect.
Well, thank you.
And you know, the cast recording is perfect. The casting is perfect. What was it like working on that?
I had done... I had learned on Dark Crystal with Jim, and I had learned on Muppets Take Manhattan, and David saw Muppets Take Manhattan. There's a lot of songs in Muppets Take Manhattan, and I think that's why he thought it'd be. It was supposed to be, I think, those of you here last night were talking to Scorsese was going to do it first, and Spike was going to even do it, I think, but...
they wanted someone taller.
No, I think they couldn't solve the switch from theater to film. And as I said last night, I always wanted to be a theater director, not a film director. It's only after a few movies I became passionate about films. But I kind of knew, I was strongly rooted in theater. So I knew that there's a difference between a theater sensibility and a movie sensibility. And part of it is the way that script was written, it was still written in theater sensibility. It was theater, except for Theater in the Round and Three-Quarter. Mostly theater is a proscenium, which is 180 degrees. And I know film is 360 degrees. And I had some ideas. As a matter of fact, the first time Geffen asked me to do it, I looked at that and I said no. And he was shocked because nobody says no to David Geffen. But I wasn't being difficult. It's just that I had no idea how to do it. It was it's like 14 songs. It was a huge plant. It was massive. Guest stars. And then I went off and did a gig in Toronto with Jim and the guys. And when the pressure is off, what came to me was, oh, okay, I got it now. It was the three backup singers. And I said, okay, I can place them anywhere because they're 360. So they became the Greek Chorus, and that's what opened up, and then I said I would do it.
And that's why it's still so good.
Oh, thank you.
The key that unlocked it for you.
That was the key that unlocked it. I couldn't break it until the pressure was off, and it just came to me. And then it was cool, yeah. And then I really love, like with a Muppet Take Manhattan, and I love creating musical numbers, and I love, all, for instance, Downtown, that Downtown song? I had blocked that in my head about 6 months before we shot it. And you guys are filmmakers, right? Okay.
Here's what I do. Everybody.
Here's what I do. It may or may not help you, but the usual thing, and I learned it this way, but I changed, was that the production designer designed something for you, say, a house, and then you do the shots to see what you can make of the story in the house. I've changed years ago. What I do is for instance, a little shot. It happened with Death at a Funeral, it happened to everything. I would take my production designer, Roy Walker, who was brilliant. He did a Rotten Scoundrels too. And it was 007, which is a massive set. It was it's called 007 because that's where the submarine base was and everything. And it was empty. But in my mind, I knew what the choreography was. So I would have a boom box there with me and Roy alone. Maybe my first was there and continuity was there. And I would have it in my head what it is. So for instance, the dentist scene, arbitrarily. I did the movements and I said, okay, so I think during this section, Steve's gonna go from here to here. That's how many steps. And then he then measured the steps to the door or the revolving door. And then from the revolving door, he goes to his office and I walked those steps and pretend it was the office, and he measured that section. And then I was in the office, and I thought, okay, there's the hallway and where Billy and he work, so I just walked that way. So essentially what I did is I gave him information, and once I had the set all set, then I knew where I was going right away.
A blueprint.
Yeah.
An actual blueprint.
Yeah.
I've read that's how Gene Kelly plotted out the Singing of the Rain note.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Stanley Donen. But I mean, look just like that.
Yeah.
Or put the puddle here.
It just makes sense.
Yeah.
It's logical,
Plan it. But that's, of course, what...
But it wasn't logical to other people because they couldn't figure it out.
Right.
You could.
I tend, for some reason, I have a I've always had a, and I think it's where maybe the Muppets and puppets helped. I always created my own blocking songs, and I think for years I did that. And then when I joined the Muppets, I worked with, you know, with Jim, we did songs, but that helped me a lot. So when before I do a show, I shoot the entire movie in my head already. Mm-hmm. I know my shots.
Right.
And then I go there, and then I change it because the moment changes things. Mm-hmm. But at least I have my shots, and I right. can always fall back on them.
Right. You're open to spontaneity.
I pray for spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned death at a funeral. It's like there's another one, death at a funeral. So good. Mm-hmm. It's these... I don't know what connects them in terms of, as I say, this thing you're able to do. My parents rewatched Bowfinger the other night for the first time in a long time, which I know backwards and forwards because it's so funny. In and out. Can we all just agree that Kevin Kline is a friggin' national treasure?
Yeah.
And the man needs to be on top of a cake somewhere?
Is. So, I'm about to say something.
You go ahead.
So, Steve Martin, you met for the first time. Or had he been on the Muppet Show?
Steve did the Muppet. It was a guest appearance on the Muppet movie.
Okay.
And then he did the Muppet Show. And then after that, then it was David Geffen's idea to cast him for the dentist. But you know, one thing I'll say, I apologize for interrupting you. It may or may not help you, but one thing I'm very studious about when I do my movies is not to shoot any billboards, TV, anything that shows the time period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't date it.
And so you might notice in all my movies, except for instance, Little Shop, there had to be a time period. There was a John Candy did a thing on the radio saying it was John Kennedy, he was the president. But on purpose, I don't shoot anything that has any time, any date. Any period piece whatsoever, because I want the movies to last.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of what they do.
Do you preview your movies?
I preview, all my movies. I mean, the dramas I don't, you know, like the score, I don't have to preview as much. But comedies, it used to be, it's not the same anymore, but it used to be that I'd get about 2-3 previews, then I'd say I need more. And I go 5, 4, 5, in and out, because Scott Rudin was gay. You seen that movie at all? Okay. Anyway, Scott Rudin was gay. Paul Rudnick was gay. And it was kind of the first big studio movie about gays.
Yeah.
And we had probably about 17 previews.
Wow.
Because it was important. Paramount tried to soften the homosexuality. And I had to respect the community, and Scott and Paul had to try and not escape from that. And so we had to find a level, and that's why I took so many previews.
So did you make changes after every preview?
It depends. I mean, for instance, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, believe it or not, I think I was only, in my first cut, I was only about 4 minutes over. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty good that way. I don't make 4 hours movies and cut them to 2 hours. I don't do that.
But I mean, do you let some gags linger a little bit longer, or not gags, but you know, some scenes linger a little bit longer?
Oh, on purpose.
Yeah.
Well, as a matter of my ex-wife at that time, we went to Bowfinger preview, and And you guys probably know this, as a director, when you go to previews, and it's tough these days because the internet judges you.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to be before internet, most of it anyway, and I wasn't judged. But what, you know, what... There's a party going on there. I lost my train of thought now.
You're with your ex-wife at Bowfinger, which is funny on its own.
Oh, yeah. So on purpose, I made it a half an hour longer than it should be. I felt I knew what I had to do, but I didn't know for sure until you put it in front of an audience. So I made it a half an hour longer, And I knew it wouldn't play well because of that. But I also knew I had to show it to see what was going on.
Right.
And it didn't, it was only okay. And so we walked out, my ex-wife said, "You better get another movie fast." But I knew that, I knew it was going to get cut down. And how you see a preview is very important. You can't really judge it for the preview. You know, it's still a work in progress.
Sure. But I mean, but like Chaplin and Keaton and Harold Lloyd, I mean, who would go back and reshoot, if necessary, after an audience preview, you know, more contemporary comedy filmmakers have gone to tweak the editing, lengthening, shortening.
Oh, sure.
Cutting completely.
I've shot, like, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels didn't have an ending when I was shooting it.
Mm-hmm.
So we were writing the ending, because I didn't like the ending that was written. I wasn't mm-hmm. going to shoot it. And so Steve and I worked at the Universal Cafe in Nice, had dinners and worked on it, and then Michael Caine would work on it, and then Glennie would work on it, and we cobbled together what I felt was good. So sometimes that happens, you know.
Yeah. In Bowfinger, the scene, I hadn't seen it since it came out. Watched it the other night. The scene I remembered most vividly is the funny scene in the movie, Eddie Murphy crossing the freeway. But watching it again, anew, it's the sounds, it's the sound effects that sell that scene. I mean, he's great. He does a great job. You did a great job executing it and editing it. But it's your use of sound.
Yeah, we had to make it dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also Eddie, when I told Eddie, we did it two takes. I took the last one. And again, I apologize for the people who were here last night. But when I talk about something, I can't give a second truth. I got to do the first truth.
Yeah.
No alternate truths for me. You know, I asked Eddie, okay, pretend there were no cars. He just went across an empty freeway. And so the cars were put in later. And so I asked him, you know, here you got to pretend there's like a motorcycle coming by, and you got to pretend there's a truck. And so Eddie's brilliant. He's a brilliant technician, comedically. And that was a huge help, too. And the sound effects, and Bill Taylor has passed. He's a great special effects guy. You know, I mean, I'm the guy who gets director credit. But there's no way I could do any of this stuff without all these people. I don't know how to do the damn special effects. I don't know how to do that stuff. And I don't know, you know, I don't know about you, but here's what I believe, okay? I don't think it should be directed by. Because, first of all, we don't direct. We don't say, you move over here. If you do that, get out of the business. That's old guard. But the other thing is, you know, when you cast individually usually, and you don't really don't know if it's going to happen until there's a read-through of the first rehearsal. And you don't really know if the people you hire are really going to do the job you hope they're going to do. And you really don't know if the post-production... So I think it... I mean, I just hope it all works. So I think movies should be, instead of directed by, it should be hoped by.
Well, that, Daddy, what do you always say? Failure?
Well, it's not original.
No, but that's...
Failure's an orphan, and success has many fathers.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
People ready to take credit for anything that works.
Yes.
Did you know that Eddie could do the Jerry Lewis Nutty Professor voice, Julius Kelp voice?
So funny.
Say that again?
The first scene where we first meet Eddie Murphy in Bowfinger, he's doing... essentially, a Jerry Lewis voice.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't notice that.
Oh, when he's, I can't even imitate it.
You could try.
Was that? Because it was Kit Ramsey.
Yeah.
Who was the star,
the
and then
star.
The Jiff was his
yes.
brother.
Yeah, which we find out later that it's his brother.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I didn't realize that.
There's a scene. He's wearing a red, bright red sweater, and he's just this hopeless goofball. But they realize that the resemblance is what's going to make the story work for them. And he does his voice. No,
it's okay. It's still funny. You can do it.
No, it's Jerry Lewis's voice from Nutty Professor.
Really,
Julius Kelp. the Nutty Professor. That's a terrible impression.
I didn't notice, but anyway. Eddie did a beautiful job in Jif. Yeah. Beautiful job.
Oh yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, you work with somebody like Steve Martin, who is just so ridiculously funny. He's so good.
And he's beyond that. He's talented as a writer. He's talented as a playwright. Yes. He's talented as a musician.
Mm-hmm. And Eddie is an incredible actor, and his timing and everything. I still think that him doing Buckwheat on SNL is just because I grew up, because of my dad, I grew up watching The Little Rascals. That still, to me, is one of the funniest things.
Eddie is brilliant. And and as I said before, I was very surprised what a great technician he was in comedy. And because you can do comedy and be sloppy, or you can be comedy and be precise. And he's quite precise if I give him thoughts, his notes.
Is having Kevin Kline in your movie like having a Stradivarius in the orchestra?
Yeah. Kevin's range is it's from Hamlet to Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
Kevin is, he's a sweetheart, but his range is extraordinary. Absolutely amazing. It was a delight to be with him,
The roster of people going through,
Well, it's bonkers. You've worked with so many incredible folks, and they've worked with you.
I've been very fortunate, but it's so weird how this happens, because it's not as if it's planned all. It's just not. I remember with for instance, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, we were trying to find somebody. I couldn't find somebody, and the producer said, "You ever tried Michael Caine?" I said, "Gee, I don't know Michael Caine. I've never seen him in a comedy. I don't know." And so we talked with Robin Williams, we talked with a lot of people, and it was getting down to shooting, and so I said, okay, let's go. So Steve and I took a Concorde to London and drove to Oxfordshire and met Michael. He was having a dinner party, and God bless Michael. He introduced us and said, "You want me to read for you?" So he took us to the library, and he read the Dr. Schaffhausen voice, the German voice. And Steve and I looked at it and said, "Yeah, of course." but it's not like I was so smart. Let's get Michael Caine. It's just, the same thing with, it happens anyway. Like with a score with Bob De Niro and Marlon Brando and Edward and things. It's not like I wanted those right away. It's just one at a time, and sometimes it just happens, you know.
Just say those three names again.
Yeah.
Because.
And Angela Bassett, too. Angela's a doll.
She'll do, yeah. It's. There are only so many people, again, when we get into this icon legend, this stuff, people use it all the time, and I think it's kind of ridiculous because then you take away.
It is weird, isn't it?
You know. But the names, I will always laugh when someone says Bob or Bobby De Niro, because it's like, that's not his name. But.
Well, it's weird to call him Robert or Mr. De Niro if you work with him.
Yeah. Well, of course.
True. I can't imagine calling him Bob, but I understand.
Yeah.
It's just it's when someone becomes real, Like you've been watching Steve Martin much of your life at this point. Yeah. I've watched Steve Martin my entire life. He's one of the funniest humans, and anything he does, you're like, yes, please, more. They say Kevin Kline, one of the greatest actors. I wish he'd work more because I love him.
Oh, he's brilliant. But all these people I've worked with, from Goldie and Billy Murray and Eddie and Steve and Martin Short. And, one thing is we all have in common is we take our comedy very seriously.
Right, right.
It's I tend to work with the two R's in comedy, rigor and restraint. And it may seem odd that I'm talking about restraint when I do Bowfinger, but within the world in which those characters inhabit and the rules in that world, they're restrained.
Absolutely. Mm.
And I think restraint, if one doesn't have restraint, in my opinion, you can see the sweat flop trying to make you funny.
Yeah. Well, that happens all too often, I'm afraid. And if there are two qualities missing from a lot of comedies, and I'm a comedy aficionado, I love comedy, great comedy, even good comedy. It's rigor and restraint, lack of discipline, a lack of understanding.
Yeah, I'm very tough on myself, and I have to answer all the questions myself before I get on the set, because I know that I'm going to get dozens and dozens of questions, and I have to be so prepared. It's all about prep. Actually, I'm writing a book on prep. It's so, you have to go the distance with the prep. It's so deep. And it's interesting, you know, for those who are directors, if you do the prep, if you really do the prep, the actors can smell it and the crew can smell it. And if you don't do the prep, the crew can smell it and the actors can smell it, okay? And it's interesting, in Bowfinger, I'm allowed to say I don't know when I've done the prep. Because there was one scene in Bowfinger, and I couldn't figure out how to shoot it. It was the four Mexicans, the immigrants across the border, who were new in the scene, and they were, what's happened, I was shooting Bowfinger, shooting Eddie Murphy driving out of his place, and for the first, that was the first time we used the four Mexicans in a scene, and they were hiding behind the bushes. It was very complicated, and I didn't know how to do it. And so in this, you can do this. If you prep, because they know I've done that, I can say, you know, guys, I don't know how to shoot that scene. I don't know how to do it. And I said, guys, you do me a favor. On Saturday, you think you could come out and help me out? And Steve, not Eddie, he wasn't necessary in the scene. Steve and the four Mexicans and everybody else came out on the Saturday and helped me because they knew I did the work. You know, and I think that's really important to know.
Mm. Well, time is our most precious entity, right? If they know that you have spent your time, that you've put in all of that effort, then they respect that. And so then they're happy to do whatever it is, you know, that you ask, because they understand that it's not coming from laziness. Right. Hey, I don't really know how this works and I don't really care. Can you fix it for me? You know?
Yeah, prep is everything. And prep is meant for me, and probably you guys too, is the way it should be. You prep and prep and prep so you know it in your bones, so you can throw it all away if necessary. And then, because the new things come up on the set, use that.
I want to ask, what are some of your favorite movies of his?
Little Shop.
What about Bob? That's in the comedy universe. I think that's
Thank you.
Up here somewhere.
That was a tough shoot.
Yeah.
We've read.
It was a notoriously tough shoot.
Yes, it was.
Shielded from the press.
Nope, wasn't.
And
but
that's
you
okay.
Lived.
I don't care.
You lived.
I don't care. Oh yeah. I mean. I don't know if I should tell the story.
Well, that's a tease that.
We can cut it if you
need. It was very tough, in part because Richard and Billy didn't get along. Nobody's fault. Richard is a very structured person. Billy is a very unstructured person.
Bill Murray.
And it's just the nature, okay? And they're both great, and Billy was brilliant, and Richard was brilliant. But there was so much tension on that set because of that, and also because there was an ending that nobody liked. And we shot again without the ending. And there was so much tension. And for the first month, I would be Laura Ziskin had her version of the script. I had my version. Disney had their version. You know, I would be cobbling together these scripts every night and trying to get the scenes the next day. So everybody thought it was a mess. Everybody just thought it was, and I didn't think so. I thought I was cool. I was cool because I kind of knew what I was doing. I did the prep work and the vision. But here's the story I shouldn't tell, okay? When I shoot or shot, I love having everybody looking at the dailies. There's a lot of reasons for that. My only rule is if you tell the actors they're either good or bad, you can't ever come again. That's all. After that, accountants can come, anybody can come. But we were going on for about a month and a half, and it was so full of tension, incredible tension, that the producer said she wanted to see an assembly. And I make assemblies, I edit as I go along, make assemblies. And that's fine. She has the right to do that. But it's important to know that when you see an assembly, you're not seeing a cut, you're seeing an assembly. And you got to know how to look at an assembly. And there was a long trailer. And that's where we were on location, is Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. And we would see our dailies in the long trailer. And on one end of the trailer was the screen, and the other end was the projection booth, okay? And the producer wanted to see it, and I said, great. So the producer sat in like a third row, and I sat in the back. And it was about 25 minutes worth of assembly. And at the end, I have to do this for you. I shouldn't say this. At the end, I was over there. There was a screen here. After a month and a half of this, the screen went black afterwards and the lights came on and she turned around and said, I know, Frank, I wish it was funny too.
Oh, dear.
And then I had two more months to shoot, you know? But what the important thing is for any filmmakers to know that if I had said, oh, shit, it's not funny, what do I do? Then you're screwed. You got to stay with you got to keep your eyes on the prize. You know, you have to listen to people. You don't have to agree with people. Listening is not agreeing. Listening is listening. But if there are really ideas that fit your vision, you have to listen to them. But it doesn't mean, as soon as you start pleasing people other than yourself, you're screwed. Hmm. Okay, that's end of that story.
Thank you.
It's not a rude story to tell.
It's not.
It really isn't.
It's not.
It really
we've heard much worse. You're right. No.
Marlon Brando.
No, I won't tell you rude stories. Marlon, it was difficult for Marlon and myself for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I blame myself. I work with two very big stars, Marlon and Orson. Mm-hmm. They both have I felt they both had a very childlike quality about them, mm-hmm. which is really, I mean, it's really what one wants is to keep that sense of wonder when you work. And I mean, Picasso said it took him 60 years to learn how to paint like a child.
Yeah.
And one tries to go back and get that wonder. And Marlon had that, and so did Orson. But Marlon, I'd read these famous stories about Marlon taking over movies, like the Frankenheimer movie, the Island, I think it was, or something, I don't know. Anyway, horrific, huh? Yeah, so, exactly. So I said, I'm not going to let him do that. I'm not going to let him take over my movie. So he came, and for the first day and a half, I was tough, and I was too tough on him. Hmm. And because he did things that were not good for the movie, and I was too tough, and then I lost him. Mm-hmm. And it was my fault, because our job as a director is to let things slide off our back and support that actor, because the actor's scared, and Marlon was scared. Even Marlon Brando is scared. Every actor is scared at some point. They're frightened. So I failed him, is what happened.
Hmm. That's a lot, though. It's a lot to.
Well, it's a chicken and
feel
egg.
That
you,
way.
You feel you failed him, but he failed you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have to be fair to me. He, because of his fear,
yeah.
I don't want to go into a lot of stories. Because of his fear and his distrust of people, and he had a reason to distrust.
Yeah.
He was a bit insulting to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't treat that way, people that way. But then he came back to try and apologize, and that's when I got tough, and that was a bad time to get tough. And I screwed up.
Okay.
It was my job to get the very best out of those actors, and the best way to do it is to have them trust you.
Yeah.
And it's a great lesson I learned. And if it ever happens to you with an actor, it happened before, and it happened again in another movie, a big movie, very big movie. And one of the actors, who will be named nameless, was annoyed at me because I wouldn't let him ad lib. And like I said, you can't, because it's the dialogue is rhythmic. It's not it's not colloquial. You can't just ad lib rhythmic dialogue. And he started on the set, starting to say, "You never let me ad lib, Frank." And I said, "You know, the important thing is not to do anything in front of the crew."
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah. I said, "Let's go to my office." And so he came in my office, and Scott Rudin did too, and Paul. And he came in my office, and I was proud of myself because I think said, "You know what? Here's the real question is, can you work with me?" That's all that matters. Can you work with me? And he unhappily said, yeah. And so he was cordial for the whole shoot. But the important thing for the director is get the job done. Mm. Can you work with me? If you can, then I'll be as generous as possible. But it's important to say we just got to keep going and I'll be as generous as possible. And I learned my lesson with Marlon.
See, this, what you were talking about, being a director means you are in charge. You are the captain of this ship. So just as you say that there are a lot of people behind you, director also tends to be the first one you blame if it's not good.
Yeah.
So that's why we say, whenever my dad says, yes, I know you didn't create, you know, failure is an orphan and success has many fathers. But it's the idea that especially you're able to look back, and obviously that helps as well, because hopefully then you don't have the same situation twice.
Right, and I learned, and I must say that again to not demean myself in Toronto, you, but rather to give myself a pat on the back. I mean, Little Shop, where I love sets where you have a lot of fun. I just want to do that. And Little Shop of Horrors, it was Vincent Gardenia passed away, wonderful actor. And he gave me the greatest compliment. He said, "The fish smells from the head," he said, we had such a great atmosphere on the set, you know, and that was such a nice thing to hear from him, who was a pro. Yeah.
Sure. All right, random question. This is out of left field. 5 seasons of The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
A famous guest star every week.
Mm-hmm.
Who pleasantly surprised you? Who did you not expect to either get along with or have a comedic sense that you needed to fill that role as guest star?
You know, the strangest thing that happened there is because when the guest stars came over to London, they were treated so well by us, and Dave Lazor, who met him on the plane, and flowers in the room, and then they came to the reading, and there was no ego. That's not how Jim worked, and it was very difficult for anybody to behave badly, because partly the other is there's you're the only human on the screen.
Right.
Now, for an actor and performer, that's fantastic. So it's hard to be unhappy there, and especially when we're on purpose between takes screwing around with them to keep their energy up.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't, I have favorite people I ever work with, but I don't have anything that I against anybody.
I'm looking for positive.
Oh, positive! Alan Arkin was a sweetheart, and we were great pen pals. It was such a loss. And Johnny Cleese is a good friend of mine, and Johnny was funny. And you know, I mean, what Jim would do and Jerry would do, Jerry Jewell, it was like almost like psychodrama. You know, Bob Hope said that Bob Hope didn't have much time to do the show. So the show was about Bob Hope not having enough time to do the show. And with Cleese, with Johnny, he said, "One thing I can't do is sing." And it was all about trying to make him sing in the show. And that's what Jim and Jerry Jewell did. You know, just it was fantastic, you know. But when you have a leader like Jim, and you have extraordinary people in the workshop, and people who, the performers, when you're all going for one thing and you have a lot of fun, you work like dogs, it's fantastic. And there's no reason for people to be unhappy, really.
Yeah.
No. But this is, again, we go back to this longevity. You know, Little Shop of Horrors, as I say, I think it's perfect. You're talking about what a wonderful time you had on that set and that it was joyful. I feel like that comes through. When we watch The Muppets or Sesame Street or any of that, as I say, I'm showing it to a 2-year-old. A lot of what we're watching is older than me. you know? And I loved it, and now she loves it. And it's a say, you know, my dad's wearing Looney Tunes today, though he has a Mickey Mouse watch. It's a big fight. But, you know, but it's like we're showing her this kind of stuff, and it holds. And she's watching. She's in love. She loves that there's, my daughter's name is Daisy. She really likes that there's a duck named Daisy. Gets very excited about it. But, you know, she's watching these characters, and she's loving them.
I just think for any human beings, whether kids or they're adults, I think if one is true and authentic, and they can smell it a mile away, and I think that's the key thing.
Yeah. Frank, we can't begin to thank you for giving
I'm sure you could try.
Bingo.
Bingo. I'm sorry, cheap joke. I'm not above cheap jokes.
No. There's no such thing as a cheap joke.
Actually, it's true. One thing Jim loved with Muppets is the stupidity of us. But it was it was smart stupidity.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I describe us all the time. Just
again. Well, I'll try to thank you.
Yeah. No, that's enough. I'm thrilled to be here, and thank you guys for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you all.